Qiyamah.
All right.
And even in hadith of Shi'as, the followers of the school of Ahlul Bayt, the Dajjal refers to one of the signs of the emergence and reappearance of Imam. But those hadiths that actually refer to such issue are very few, let's say less than five. And they're not quite valid to say, okay, 100%, they are valid to say that, okay, this Dajjal can be a sign of arrival of Imam, among the signs. Definite or indefinite signs of arrival of Imam. So we said that up until now, we said that Dajjal has three different meanings. One in Christian world.
All right.
In Christianity, that it means Antichrist, a person who is a liar. And also in Islamic version of it, actually in Sunni sources, it refers to
the
time of the beginning of Qiyamah, or the Day of Judgment.
Right.
And in a hadith of Shia, it refers to one of the signs of reappearance of Imam. But actually, most of these hadith cannot be trusted because...
Right. The number is so less.
Yeah, even the ones even from the Shia or the Sunni.
All right.
Because whatever we have about the Dajjal, has been even narrated for the earlier nations as well.
All right.
So we have in the hadith that they had their own Dajjal with them. And we had, again, in hadith we have that before the main Dajjal, 70 Dajjals will emerge. So based on the hadith, in comparison, in analysis of the hadith, we might reach to this conclusion that this Dajjal might be a person or a person who tries to deceive or play a trick on the people, or most probably a current or let's say a government or a taghut, because Dajjal tries to deviate the right path of guidance and actually tries to deviate people from going in the right path. So this is more acceptable to say that what Dajjal is. So in case we think that, okay, when after Imam after Imam emerges and actually Imam comes, a person by the name of Dajjal comes and wants to kill Imam with such and such, let's say, characteristics, and his eye or her eye is in the middle of his forehead. So these are the things that cannot be
really trusted,
documented and trusted. But because, you know, the reason that we are referring to this is that every prophet from even the nations before the Islam, they tried to warn their own people from the danger of a Dajjal. And it means that they were trying to warn their people from a taghut, something which stands in front of the religion of the believers and muwahideen and the people of tawheed, the followers of the uniqueness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So it can be a sort of, let's say, simile or let's say an irony, let's say, for a global and universal arrogance.
All right.
Or taghut. That tries with its beautiful appearance, tries to deceive people. Because in the hadith we have that the Dajjal has everything with him from the materialistic point of view. He has a city of food and a city of water with it. So it means that it cannot be naturally a person or a single person or, let's say, a limited number of people, but rather a current or, let's say, a government or governments who stand in front of the rightness of Imam alayhi salam.
Yes.
And that's why people are asked and are warned to be careful of not to be entrapped with the danger of Dajjal.
Dr. Alevi, I'll be back to you on the same note after a very short break. To listeners, stay tuned to IRIV English Radio.
I can feel your eyes, like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old I feel
many of the sources I went through were translating the word Dajjal as the enemy of Allah. Mm-hmm. So you're saying that we have many narrations from many different schools of thoughts that say, some say he's a person with the left eye on his middle forehead and then with different characteristics, but something that was common mm-hmm. in these different narrations was that he was, or this government or this person or whatever Dajjal is something that's a barrier mm-hmm. in the way of Allah, is something that is deceiving the people from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And you even said that this could even be dunya, the materialistic world, which reminds me of one of the hadiths from Imam Ali alayhi salam, that dunya, this materialistic world, is something like that of a lady who puts on a lot of makeup and deceives thousands of people and is belongs to none.
Yeah. I wanted to say that it's true that you actually likened it to the dunya, but to my own understanding, it could be even more likened to the world of Taghut, to the world, because the Taghut itself is beautifying the world for its followers, right?
Yes.
The world of arrogance. It could be a government. It could be even some governments who together are trying to stand in front of the rightness and truthfulness of
what we have
reality.
Been seeing.
Yeah. So I think
it
we can sense it.
It cannot be confined to
we
some
can
one
sense
particular
it today
thing,
that,
yes.
Okay, there are some powers who stand in front of the rightfulness of the imam. And we see that they are trying to deceive people by the beauties of the world.
Yes.
You see? So the cases can be now touched and sensed, and that's why we can now have a good, let's say, understanding of the hadith, I think, in these days better even than before.
Yes. So the chain of narrations, when we even analyze them, is not much valid when it comes to Dajjal. You said, like, it's less than, we may have less than 5 narrations about Dajjal, mm-hmm. and different schools of thought say different things. But what could be more accepted is that Dajjal could not be a man. Mm-hmm. It could be a government. It could be a materialistic world. Yeah. It could be anything that stands in the way of Allah.
Actually, here when we are talking about the narrations of the school of Ahlul Bayt and the school of Ahl Sunnah, we are not saying that whatever they have understood from their hadith is wrong. But, I mean, the kind of interpretation that can be made is that...
After analyzing the hadith.
Yeah, I mean, even the hadith that came from Shia sources are not that valid and that not well documented. That even, as I said, there are almost 2 or 3 that refer to Dajjal in this sense. And so to connect it to one of the signs of reappearance of Imam
is not a very definite sign.
It's not a good, let's say, understanding of the hadith. And also the one that actually refers to the a sign of the starting of the Qiyamah and the Day of Judgment, also from which is coming from the narrations of Ahl Sunnah, also cannot be taken from that hadith as well.
Now, since we are talking about the signs, and we said that this could not, like the existence of Dajjal could not be considered a very definite sign of the reappearance of Imam. Mm-hmm. Takes me back to the question, what could be the signs of the reappearance of Imam? Can you like just mention some of the signs for us?
Yeah. Actually, in case we want to dive into the signs of reappearance of Imam or the signs for the advent of Imam alayhi salam, and if we refer to the books of hadith and narration to see what are the signs, we can categorize 2 sorts of, let's say, a hadith that we can put some of them on a definite signs and some in indefinite signs.
Indefinite signs.
For the definite signs, the signs that in the language of hadith, they have been emphasized by the Imams and Ahlul Bayt, alayhi salam. They said that these 5 signs will definitely happen. They might happen, all of them might happen in even 1 hour. This is something that can happen.
Okay.
But whatever we have heard and from, or we have read and learned from the hadith of Ahlul Bayt, we have some certain and definite signs of reappearance of Imam, that there are five.
All right.
And there are some indefinite ones, for example, the ones that we have in, again, the books of hadith, that there are many, and we can refer to some of them then, but we have no guarantee for the indefinite ones to happen. But based on some hadith that have been collected, we can also include them as well.
All right.
As for the five definite
ones,
certain signs, we can actually refer to Khuruj of Safiyani, that is the emergence of Safiyani.
All right.
Emergence of Safiyani is, let's say, definite sign of the time of Zuhur and, let's say, reappearance and advent of Imam. The appearance of, let's say, the emergence of Yamani, a person from Yemen.
All right.
Is also another sign. A divine or let's say, heavenly voice that actually everyone hears by his own by his own language or her own language, is the third one. And the martyrdom of a person, or nafs al-zakiyya, that a person who was a purified person. And also khasf bayda, that is when the earth is sinking a group of, let's say, enemies of the Imam. When the people are swallowed by the earth in an era or in a desert called bayda. So these are among the five certain definite signs of the reappearance of Imam that we can talk about these ones. That to say that who was Sufyani and who actually, what are the characteristics of him about the Yamani and the divinely and heavenly voice, we can have some explanations later on.
We have Dajjal, and that could be considered just as a concept, not definitely a man. And Dajjal is not a definite sign of the reappearance. Mm-hmm. Apart from them, we came to the signs, and you said that signs are categorized into definite and indefinite signs, mm-hmm. among which five are definite. And on those five signs, we are again going to talk on another session. Thank you so much, Dr. Levy, for being with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Nearly all of Spain faced an extreme fire risk in recent days as hundreds of people were evacuated in the northwestern Zamora region. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Spain Ravaged by Wildfires as Drought and Heat Wave Broils Europe. Here's more. Hundreds of people have been forced from their homes and tens of thousands of acres have been burned through wildfires across Spain, with global climate experts warning that nearly the entire country is at the risk of facing the flames. All the country faces extreme fire risk as a result of the heat wave and drought. Spain and much of Europe is experiencing, the World Meteorological Organization reported recently, noting that a Saharan dust cloud that's drifted north toward the continent may also have an impact on public health. Roughly 61,000 acres of land in the northwestern province of Zamora had been destroyed by the wildfires, and several Spanish cities reported temperatures topping 104 degrees Fahrenheit in recent days. At least 18 villages have been evacuated in Zamora, where a lightning storm reportedly started the wildfires. As a result of climate change, heat waves are starting earlier. Experts say extreme heat and drought, which have both been linked to the human-caused climate crisis, are causing the fires to spread rapidly. The country's drought has stretched for several months, with officials saying in March that Spain's reservoirs were at just over 44% capacity, the lowest level since 1995. Just as climate experts last week warned that the current heat wave in the United States, affecting about a third of the nation's population, was indicative of a new normal, European observers said the extreme weather facing Spain and other European countries are the consequences of continued fossil fuel extraction and will continue unless global policymakers ensure carbon emissions are rapidly drawn down. Claire Nolis, spokesperson for WMO in Geneva, told The Independent, as a result of climate change, heat waves are starting earlier. France has also been struck by extreme heat, with temperatures more than 10 degrees Fahrenheit higher than usual at this time of year. In recent days, French officials have recorded temperatures as high as 102.2 degrees Fahrenheit in the country's southwest. The long-lasting heat wave is a marker of climate change, climatologist Matteo Sorel told NPR. In northern Italy, the Po, the country's longest river, was 10 feet below its normal level, with officials blaming the drought. As the Times reported recently, fruit and vegetable production could be reduced by up to 40% after 3 months of drought, because the river Po irrigates the region where nearly half of the country's food is produced. Emergency Decarbonization Now said International Climate Change Movement Extinction Rebellion in response to the reports out of Italy. While Spanish emergency workers were battling the continent's most widespread wildfires, a similar crisis was reportedly worsening in Germany, where three villages near Berlin were evacuated due to an approaching fire. Temperatures in cities including Dresden and Cottbus surpassed 102 degrees Fahrenheit, and the evacuations outside Berlin affected about 600 people who were ordered to stay in a community center until the fires were brought under control. Emma Jackson, an organizer with 350 Canada, said the wildfires taking place in drought-ridden regions must not be treated as natural disasters, but as crimes perpetrated by arsonists, fossil fuel companies, and the politicians who enable them. Jackson said, only an internationalist working class movement can stop them.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's topic, the effects of upbringing on the moral character. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. The upbringing and nurturing of a personality or a child is a tough task. It's not easy thing to upbring a child. Many people think that nurturing a child, upbringing a child is something you have to do regardless of your own personality. They think that it's detached from your own personality. So you can upbring and nurture a child towards good direction, towards the right path, detached from your own self, what you are, and the way you act, and the way you have nurtured and you have brought yourself up has no connection with the upbringing of a child. So is this a right idea? No doubt. And there is no any doubt that this idea is wrong. Bringing up a child, nurturing a child, is very much related to our own personality. It's not detached from you. You with your own character, your own behavior, you with your own qualities affect your child. They affect the people around you. So if you want to have a good effect on the moral character of your child or the people around you, if you want your upbringing affect really his moral character, first you look at yourself. Look at your own moral qualities. So you may know how eventually you will positively play your role in upbringing of your child. Welcome back. This is A to Z. We were talking about the effects of upbringing and nurturing upon the moral character. Well, no doubt that the upbringing of a child is a task which starts from our own personality. If you want to direct your child, if you want to direct your friend, if you want to direct the people around you towards the path of perfection and excellence, start with yourself. If you nurture yourself and if you upbring yourself, if you nurture yourself with moral qualities, with good behavior, and with right way of thinking and acting, this will eventually affect your child. So the most important and crucial thing, which is normally neglected in the upbringing of a child, is the point of very crucial importance, and that is your own personality. The upbringing and nurturing of other is rationally and fundamentally related to upbringing and nurturing of your own character. So if you have a child, if you have a brother, if you have a friend, if you have anyone in your life and you want to positively have an effect on him in his upbringing and his moral character, please think about yourself. Think about your own actions. Think about the way you are treating others in front of him. Look at him, how you are acting in front of him, how your behavior with other people in front of him. This inner character and this behavior of your own will eventually play its role in upbringing of that child and forming his moral character. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala help us to play a good and positive role in the lives of our own children and people surrounding us. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
In the limelight.
The super rich have rigged the system with impunity for decades and they are now reaping the benefits, says Oxfam International Executive Director. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by John Quayle, journalist. This article is published under the heading Tax Billionaire Wealth and Pandemic Profits, says Oxfam, to end inequality that literally kills. Here's more. In the shadow of the Davos Summit of Global Elites taking place, a new report from Oxfam International details how skyrocketing inequality during 2 years of the global COVID-19 pandemic surged to a point where a new billionaire was created in the world nearly every day, while over 1 million people are now being pushed into poverty at almost the same daily rate. The new report, titled Profiting from Pain, is the latest accounting of how the pandemic has only deepened grotesque discrepancies between the haves and have-nots of the world, showing that while 573 new billionaires were created since the pandemic began, approximately 1 billionaire every 30 hours, an estimated 263 million are expected to crash into extreme poverty this year, a rate of 1 million people every 33 hours. Such stark realities and gross injustice around the world, the anti-poverty group concludes, is clearly evidence that a tax on billionaire wealth and windfall pandemic profits is urgently needed to address crucial needs. Billionaires are arriving in Davos to celebrate an incredible surge in their fortunes. The pandemic and now the steep increases in food and energy prices have simply put been a bonanza for them. Meanwhile, decades of progress on extreme poverty are now in reverse, and millions of people are facing impossible rises in the cost of simply staying alive, said Gabriela Butcher, executive director of Oxfam International. Among the key findings of the report, today, 2,668 billionaires, 573 more than in 2020, own $12.7 trillion, an increase of $3.78 trillion. The world's 10 richest men own more wealth than the bottom 40% of humanity, 3.1 billion people. The richest 20 billionaires are worth more than the entire GDP of sub-Saharan Africa. A worker in the bottom 50% would have to work for 112 years to earn what a person in the top 1% gets in a single year. And high informality and overload due to care tasks have kept 4 million women in Latin America and the Caribbean out of the workforce. Half of working women of color in the U.S. earn less than $15 an hour. While a tall stack of reports have documented such trends since the pandemic took hold in early 2020, Oxfam's latest study shines a bright light on the massive profits in the key sectors of energy, food, and pharmaceutical companies, all of which are able to consolidate financial gains due to their monopoly control over commodities essential to society. According to Butcher, the fortunes of the world's billionaires have not increased because they are now smarter or working harder than the average worker. Many who faced layoffs, lack of hours, fractured families, childcare crises, and dangerous work conditions throughout the pandemic. She said the super rich have rigged the system with impunity for decades and they're now reaping the benefits. They have seized a shocking amount of the world's wealth as a result of privatization and monopolies, gutting regulation and work rights, while stashing their cash in tax havens, all with the complicity of governments. At the same time, she added, hundreds of millions of regular workers and their families are skipping meals, turning off the heating, falling behind on bills, and wondering what they can possibly do next to survive. Across East Africa, one person is likely dying every minute from hunger. This grotesque inequality is breaking the bonds that hold us together as humanity. It is divisive, corrosive, and dangerous. This is inequality that literally kills. The report notes that the profit margins of the world's big oil companies doubled during the pandemic, while the cost of energy worldwide is projected to soar by 50% this year, the largest increase in energy prices, the group noted, since 1973. Giant food companies that control a bulk of the world's food supply and the large pharmaceutical companies, some like Johnson & Johnson, which control large portions of the COVID-19 vaccine supply, have been swimming in profits since the virus struck. With the world's billionaire class and national leaders meeting in Davos, as they pretend to meet as stewards of international leadership, Oxfam said there is one clear thing they should do if they want to be taken seriously: support a tax on billionaire wealth. Among other things, Oxfam calls for a one-off solidarity taxes on billionaires' pandemic windfalls to fund support for people facing rising food and energy costs and a fair and sustainable recovery from COVID-19. citing the nearly $8 trillion in tax havens that the global elite is believed to have stashed around the world. The group indicated the global tax system, which has never been defensible, is no longer sustainable in the face of such enormous challenges. The group is also calling for an end to crisis profiteering by introducing a temporary excess profit tax of 90% to capture the windfall profits of big corporations across all industries. Oxfam estimates that such a tax on less than 36 super profitable multinational companies could have generated $104 billion in revenue in 2020 alone. Lastly, Oxfam says a permanent tax on extreme wealth and the disruption of monopoly power by huge multinationals is essential to equalize the world's economy, lift billions of people out of poverty, and to fund the kind of investments on healthcare, climate action, and social protection for all the low and middle-income people of the world. The extremely rich and powerful are profiting from pain and suffering. This is unconscionable, said Bucha. Over 2 years since the pandemic began, after more than 20 million estimated deaths from COVID-19 and widespread economic disruption, she said government leaders in Davos face a choice: act as proxies for the billionaire class who plunder their economies, or take bold steps to act in the interest of their great majorities.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Majh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A major benefit brought by Imam Khomeini was familiarizing people with concept of resistance. This is the part of the speech delivered on June 4th, 2022 by Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution. On the 33rd demise anniversary of Imam Khomeini, greetings be upon him. Our young and intelligent generation, which is going to undertake the national and revolutionary duty to take the second step of the revolution and manage the future of the country, needs a real software. In order to correctly tread the path of the revolution, which will help Iran and the Iranian nation reach the summit, the young generation needs a reliable and comprehensive software to rely on. This software, which could be accelerating, facilitating, and even transforming at certain times, is Imam's lessons. Lessons that can be sought in Imam's statements and behavior. The first point that should be discussed about Imam is the leadership of the greatest revolution in the history of all revolutions. I'll explain this leadership later. Why do we call it the greatest revolution in the history of revolutions? In the history of revolutions, there are many small and big revolutions. The most famous one is the Great French Revolution, which was conducted in 1789, the 18th century. And another famous revolution is the Soviet Revolution carried out in 1917, the 20th century.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
These two revolutions are the most famous revolutions in the history of revolutions. But the Islamic revolution is greater than these two. Why? There are different reasons. I will cite an important and fundamental reason, and that is these two revolutions, the French Revolution and the Soviet Revolution, were conducted by the people. It was the people who brought them victory. But after the revolution was conducted, the people were completely sidelined. The people failed to play any part in the continuation of the revolution that had been conducted by them with all their heart and soul on the streets. What was the result? The result was that these two revolutions quickly deviated from their initial popular course. After 12, 13 years of the Great French Revolution, a revolution that had been carried out against the king and against monarchy, turned into a monarchy of another ilk. Napoleon came to power, wore the crown, and monarchy reappeared. He was in power for almost 15 years. Later, he was ousted, and the same family, which the French Revolution had been formed against, returned and took the matters in their hands. The Bourbons, they came to power again. When the people are not in their arena, this is what happens.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You've guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
EU leaders held video calls throughout Tuesday to prepare for a summit on Thursday and Friday at which Ukraine and Moldova will be granted candidate status, which means they move a step closer to joining the 27-country bloc. Georgia will be placed to a stage just below candidate status. EU affairs ministers also met on Tuesday to lay the groundwork.
That's, I think, a very important message. And it's a very important message which comes in a special time where we see this renewed geopolitical rivalry, new global tensions.
The head of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, has tweeted, "Ukrainians are ready to die for the European perspective. We want them to live with us, the European dream." Not everyone is impressed, given the current state of the EU.
I'd say the Ukrainians would rather live than die. And I'd say now the notion that they want to die for any European dream is a bit fanciful now at best.
Moscow is clearly being told to take note that the EU family is growing.
This is a powerful signal. This is a powerful signal that should be heard, not only in Ukraine.
But the message seems to have fallen flat on its face. Vladimir Putin says he's no objections to Ukraine joining the EU. The Kremlin's issue has always been related to Kiev becoming a member of the NATO military alliance. It's been reported that officials in the European Commission filled out the country's EU application form. A number of legislators point out the EU's own studies have found that Ukraine is highly corrupt. Therefore, they suggest the country is not eligible. Analysts say it could take up to 10 years for Ukraine to become a full member of the bloc. In this context, it has been suggested by some lawmakers here that the true motive is to yet again use Ukraine as a pawn to try and undermine Russia. Jerome Hughes at the European Parliament, Brussels.
Day one of a three-day strike that's made London's underground network grind to a crawl. Stations normally teeming with people, either closed or offering only a skeletal service. The advice from the authorities, take the bus. Prime Minister Boris Johnson criticized the biggest strike in Britain in a generation as an unnecessary aggravation.
I want to emphasize to everybody this morning why I think those strikes are so wrong, and so unnecessary.
An inconvenience it may be, but the unions say the government left them no choice.
Some of our members have not had a pay rise for the third anniversary now. We can resolve that if we've got a proper negotiating framework, but the fact is that Grant Shapps, Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson are dictating the terms of this dispute. Now, they can either facilitate a settlement or they can block one. At the moment, they're blocking one.
And all this, of course, comes with a cost to the City of London and to the people.
The London Chamber of Commerce says the cost of a strike like this to London's economy is tens of millions of dollars a day. But perhaps the biggest impact the strike is having is the headache it's causing to the nearly 5 million commuters who use the underground to get from A to B on a daily basis.
I think, you know, it's holding people to ransom.
I would say a major inconvenience.
I support the workers getting the right pay they need, and obviously they work really hard. But it's hard not to get annoyed when your journey time is double.
As a teacher, as someone who's just graduating into a profession where there has not been a real terms pay rise in 9 years, I look to the rail workers and I look to the RMT as a beacon of hope.
The strike has shown how dependent London is on its underground network and how powerful unions are. Negotiations for a compromise are ongoing, and so are the strikes. And it doesn't stop with the rail workers. Other professions, such as teaching and healthcare, are also considering industrial action in the UK's summer of unrest. Saeed Purza, London.
Shedding tears of joy after years of longing for the chance to visit a land described as the land of revelation in the Holy Quran. Thousands of Iranians have arrived in the city of Medina, or the city of the Prophet, as it hosts the final resting place of the Prophet Muhammad. Direct flights from Iran arrive in Saudi cities of Medina and Jeddah and will continue until 4th of July. A large number of Iranian pilgrims will first stay in Medina for 6 days and five nights to visit the Prophet's mosque and the Baqi Cemetery, among other sites, before leaving for Mecca to perform the annual Hajj pilgrimage.
Being in a place that the Holy Prophet Muhammad and her daughter Lady Fatima, Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein had been is an amazing spiritual experience.
I've been to lots of holy shrines, but here I feel different. I feel absolute peace and detached from the world.
The outbreak of the coronavirus limited trips to Mecca and Medina for 2 years, with only a limited number of Saudi pilgrims being allowed to perform it over the period. Figures show some 5.8 million Iranians are on a waiting list for traveling to Saudi Arabia to perform Hajj, while many of them have been awaiting for as long as 15 years. Going around the Prophet's mosque, you can see Iranians overwhelmed with emotions, most of them describing their visit to Medina as a unique experience.
It's impossible to describe the atmosphere in the Prophet's mosque. You can't understand how it feels until you visit the mosque.
I feel God has bestowed His blessing upon me to be the pilgrim of the Prophet's tomb and be in this spiritual environment. It's truly exceptional.
In 2019, the last Hajj before the outbreak of the coronavirus, about 85,000 Iranian pilgrims visited Saudi Arabia. But this year, with the reduction of quotas in Islamic countries, nearly 40,000 people from Iran are allowed to participate in the annual event.
Thousands of Iranians have arrived in the city of Medina, and many more are on their way to get to this holy city. This is while many more Iranians, thousands, have to wait for at least another year so that they maybe get the chance to visit this holy city once in their life. Mahdi Abbasian, Medina.
Hundreds of Palestinians attended a national conference in the blockaded Gaza Strip to mark the first anniversary of the victory of Palestinian resistance against the Israeli regime in the Sword of Al-Quds battle. The Gaza-based resistance groups, mainly Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, fired more than 4,000 rockets towards the Israeli-occupied territories during the 11-day war. The Sword of Al-Quds battle began when Hamas's Izzeddin Qassam brigades attacked the Israeli regime in retaliation to Israeli aggressions on Palestinians in Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. During the battle, Israeli attacks claimed the lives of over 260 Palestinians, including scores of children and women. Addressing the conference via satellite, the head of the Political Bureau of Hamas movement, Ismail Haniyeh, warned the Israeli regime against holding the so-called flag march in Al-Quds.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the Sword of Al-Quds battle will be a walk in the park compared to any future battles with Palestinian resistance groups. The Zionists must not test our patience, and they must stop their provocations, especially in Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Palestinians believe that the Sword of Al-Quds battle has united their ranks. During the 11-day war, all Palestinian factions in the Gaza Strip worked together through the Joint Chamber of Military Operations.
During the Sword of Al-Quds battle, Palestinians were united together against the Israeli forces. The Sword of Al-Quds battle exposed the weakness of the Israeli regime. The Palestinian people in Gaza, in Al-Quds, and in the occupied West Bank will always fight for their rights.
Palestinian resistance groups have been holding military maneuvers following the Sword of Al-Quds battle to confront any new Israeli war amid the increasing warmongering rhetoric by the Israeli regime.
Observers say that Palestinian resistance groups fought a fierce battle against the Israeli regime last year, forcing Tel Aviv to declare a unilateral ceasefire. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The drama theatre of Mariupol. It is the scene of the alleged single most deadly war crime so far in this brutal conflict. Depending on who you believe, it was either a Russian airstrike or done by the Ukrainians to blame it on Russia. The words children are still scrawled on the pavement outside, written in order to ward off a Russian strike. This man worked at the theatre.
I talked to emergency workers a week ago. Our fire brigade is over there, and they told me they found two more dead bodies.
He breaks down and walks away, unnecessarily ashamed of his tears.
I lost everything. What is left for me here? I have worked here all my life.
This is the second time that I've been here in the last few days. Since the last time, there's a little bit more rubble being cleared up. Interestingly, you can just walk straight in, even though it's a crime scene or a former crime scene, and still a site where it's still pretty dangerous in places. But you can walk straight in, it's that easy. But finding out just what happened here is a little harder. At the very least, I wanted to find out just how many people had died here. Estimates range from around 30 to over 600. A workman took me down to the basement, but told me his team had only recovered three bodies from the rubble. He also grumbled that they could have worked much faster if they hadn't been ordered to remove brick by brick. due to, as he called them, fake stories about hundreds underneath. Some eyewitnesses and previous media reports say that there were over 100 outside the theatre at a field kitchen. None survived, they said.
We thought there would be between 500 to 1,000 dead. There are three floors, but only 20 bodies were dug out, which means the others were led out from the theatre. Outside, beside the kitchen, there were 15 bodies, thank God.
Witnesses say there was 100 people outside at a food shelter, and they were all killed. Is that what you saw?
No, they only found 20 inside the basement and 15 outside, that's all. We thought that there were 1,000 dead, and we were going around these ruins shouting if there was anyone alive still. There were arms and legs. It's difficult to put it into words.
Alexander also finds it hard to hold back the tears. If this was a Russian strike, it would still constitute a war crime. But have the figures been exaggerated to cause greater uproar?
Behind me, there's a famous Russian journalist and TV personality. I've spoken to them. They are unsurprisingly very clear that this was a Ukrainian strike to blame on the Russians. But there isn't just a battle on the ground here in Ukraine. There's also a propaganda war as Russia seeks to justify its invasion, and NATO and Ukraine seek to make Russia out to be committing heinous war crimes.
At the nearest hospital, I speak to a medic who was working at the time of the explosion.
Maybe it was a strike from the air. According to another account, it was mined and detonated. I cannot say for sure. It's not clear.
Why couldn't you get to the theatre as an ambulance driver?
At that time, the Russian military didn't let us go to the theatre. There were battles going on nearby.
If Alexander's testimony is to be believed, and if the workmen are correct about there being few bodies in the rubble, then did the Russians take away hundreds of bodies in the hours after the explosion, in which they took control of the area and before the morning? Possibly. In an honest world, an independent investigation would be carried out to find out what happened and how many people died. But for now, as the war continues to rage, that seems unlikely. As they say, history is written by the winners. Johnny Miller, Mariupol.
Amid a decline in military operations since the UN ceasefire took effect in April, the number of victims of banned weapons in Yemen keeps rising. Remnants of Saudi cluster bombs are taking more lives as Riyadh refuses to allow badly needed equipment, including mine detectors, to enter the war-torn country. Yemen's Mine Action Center reported 120 cases since the start of the truce, 26 of them in the first third of June.
Since the beginning of this year, 326 people have fallen victim to leftover cluster bombs. 120 of them alone have been killed since the start of the truce. The bombings of the Saudi-led coalition continue to claim the lives of innocent citizens on a daily basis. Unfortunately, the Saudi-led coalition has been preventing the entry of necessary equipment for years, even though our work is for humanitarian purposes. Therefore, we believe that the coalition seeks to kill civilians even after the end of the war.
The Mine Action Center says the Saudi-led coalition has prevented the entry of mine detectors to Sana'a since 2018 for no good reason, and field teams are still working despite all the risks.
The biggest problem that the center faces is the lack of mine detectors and field equipment. We have been facing this problem since the outset, and unfortunately, the devices and personal protection equipment were not provided even throughout the years of war. In 2018, the United Nations informed us that our equipment had arrived in Djibouti. But much to our surprise, part of it was held by the Saudi-led coalition and some was handed over to other parties not affiliated with us, and we have not received anything until this moment.
During the seven-year war, the Saudi-led coalition has used 15 types of internationally prohibited cluster bombs in its attacks against residential areas across Yemen. However, officials say relevant international organizations refrain from cooperating for political reasons. People here are dying due to the remnants of internationally banned weapons used by the Saudi-led coalition. Experts believe the number of victims will continue to rise unless the coalition allows the needed equipment to defuse the weapons that kill Yemeni women and children to enter Yemen. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Tens of thousands of union members marched through Brussels city centre on Monday, calling for more support to deal with the cost of living, which is rising by the day. Inflation in Belgium has hit 9%. The Eurozone average is 8.1%.
The prices of electricity, water, all the supplies are going up. And the wages stays the same.
I have a bill to pay 6,000 euro for gas and electric. That's not normal.
All the other costs are very high. Energy, electricity, gas, but also food.
It's cheaper if I stay home than if I go and to work. That's not good.
The demonstration was organized to coincide with a national one-day strike.
Belgium has been brought to a standstill by this strike.